Thus Spoke Zarathustra by Friedrich Nietzsche, an audio summary narrated for the AIEIO book library. A warning before we start. This is not a book of arguments, and any summary of it is a compromise. Nietzsche wrote it between 1883 and 1885 in bursts of 10 days at a time, and he wrote it as a novel, or something closer to scripture. It has a hero, a plot, songs, parables, and jokes. He subtitled it A Book for All and None, and he seems to have meant it. Everyone can read it, and almost nobody will read it as he intended. The style is deliberate. Nietzsche is parodying Martin Luther's German Bible, and the prose deliberately sounds like prophecy. That choice is the reason the book is so quotable, and also the reason it has been so consistently and so badly misused. A sentence lifted out of Zarathustra can be made to mean almost anything. We will come back to that at the end, because it matters more for this book than for any other in this library. The hero is named for Zoroaster, the ancient Persian prophet who, in Nietzsche's reading, first divided the world into good and evil. Nietzsche's reasoning is characteristically sharp. The man who made the original error should be the one to come back and undo it. The plot, in one sentence, a man comes down from a mountain to tell humanity that God is dead, discovers that nobody wants to hear it, works out what has to be built in the ruins, and then spends the rest of the book learning to bear his own teaching. To understand what Zarathustra is for, you need the sentence that comes before it. God is dead. Nietzsche first published that line in The Gay Science a year before Zarathustra, and it is almost always misread. It is not a boast, and it is not an argument for atheism. Nietzsche is not saying that a deity has been disproved. He is making a claim about European civilization, that belief in the Christian God had already lost its power to organize life, that the educated classes no longer really believed and had not noticed, and that the consequences of this had not yet arrived. In The Gay Science, the announcement is made by a madman carrying a lantern in the morning, and the crowd laughs at him. He tells them they have killed God themselves and do not know what they have done. Then he says the crucial thing, "I have come too early." The light of dead stars takes time to arrive. The consequence Nietzsche feared was not immorality. It was nihilism, which he defined as the condition in which the highest values devalue themselves, and there is no answer to the question why. If the entire structure of Western meaning, truth, morality, and purpose rested on a foundation that has quietly given way, then everything built on it is in danger, including the parts we think of as secular. So Zarathustra is not a book attacking religion. That work was already done. This is a book about what you build afterwards, and its central worry is that we will build nothing, and be comfortable, and call it happiness. Zarathustra is 30 when he goes into the mountains. He stays for 10 years, alone with an eagle and a serpent, and at 40 he wakes one morning with the feeling that he is over full and must give something away. He addresses the sun and says that even the sun would have no happiness without those it shines on. He calls this going under, and it is one of Nietzsche's deliberate puns. The word means both descent and destruction. On the way down, he meets an old saint in the forest, a hermit who loves God and has withdrawn from human beings because he finds them imperfect. They part on friendly terms, and once alone, Zarathustra says to himself, the line the whole book hangs from. Could it be possible this old saint has not yet heard that God is dead? He arrives at a town where a crowd has gathered in the marketplace to watch a tightrope walker. Mistaking their attention for interest, he preaches. I teach you the overman, he says. Man is something that shall be overcome. What have you done to overcome him? He tells them that what is great in man is that he is a bridge and not an end. They laugh at him. They think he is the warm-up act. So he tries the opposite approach and describes the thing he holds in most contempt, in the hope that disgust will move them where aspiration did not. He describes the last man, the human being who has made everything small, who has invented happiness, who has a little pleasure for the day and a little pleasure for the night, who no longer shoots the arrow of his longing beyond himself, who blinks and says, what is love, what is creation, what is longing, what is a star? And the crowd cheers, give us this last man, they shout. Make us into these last men. It is the cruelest joke in the book, and it lands on Zarathustra, not on them. Then the tightrope walker sets out, a jester leaps over him, and he falls to his death at Zarathustra's feet. Dying, he says he is losing nothing but his life. Zarathustra tells him he has made danger his vocation, and there is nothing contemptible in that, and promises to bury him with his own hands. He carries the corpse out of the town, and by morning he has understood his mistake. He will not speak to crowds. He will not be a shepherd, because a shepherd needs a herd. He will look for companions, fellow creators, and he will lure the many away from the herd rather than preach to it. Part 1 opens with the parable that is the most useful single passage in the book, and the one most worth taking with you. Zarathustra describes three transformations of the spirit. First, the spirit becomes a camel. The camel is the reverent one, the one who kneels down and asks to be well loaded. It seeks out what is difficult. It wants to bear the heaviest things, to humiliate itself in order to wound its pride, to love those who despise it, to feed on the acorns and grass of knowledge. The camel is discipline, tradition, education, obedience. Nietzsche is not sneering at this stage. It is necessary, and a spirit that skips it is worthless. Then the camel goes into the loneliest desert, and there the second metamorphosis happens. The spirit becomes a lion. It wants to be master in its own desert, and it fights a great dragon whose name is Thou Shalt. On every scale of the dragon, a value glitters, and the dragon says all value has already been created, and I am all created value. The lion cannot create new values. What it can do is create the freedom for new creation, and that requires a sacred no to duty. The lion is critique, refusal, the destruction of what was inherited. The lion says I will, but the lion cannot build, which is why there is a third metamorphosis, and it is the surprising one. The spirit becomes a child. The child is innocence and forgetting, a new beginning, a game, a self-propelling wheel, a first movement, a sacred yes. What the lion could not do, the child does, because the child does not experience creation as rebellion. It has forgotten the dragon. It creates the way a child plays, without needing permission and without needing to be against anything. The point people miss is the order. You cannot begin as the child. Freedom that has not first carried something and then refused something is not freedom, it is just ignorance. And the goal is not the lion, which is where most rebellion stops, permanently defined by what it opposes. The two figures at the center of the book are best understood as a pair, because each defines the other. The Übermensch, usually translated as Overman or Superman, is Nietzsche's answer to the question of what human beings are for once God is dead. He is careful never to define it precisely, and that is not evasion, it is the point. A fully specified goal would be another tablet of values handed down from outside, which is the thing he is trying to end. What we can say is what it is not. It is not a biological type, and it is not a race. It is not a superior man of the present day. And Nietzsche has contempt for the successful men of his own era. It is not a supernatural being. The Overman is human self-overcoming, taken as an ongoing project. A person who creates values out of themselves rather than inheriting them, who says yes to existence, including its suffering, who is the meaning of the earth rather than a pilgrim passing through it towards somewhere better. That last phrase matters. Remain faithful to the earth, Zarathustra says, and do not believe those who speak to you of otherworldly hopes. Nietzsche's objection to Christianity is not primarily that it is false. It is that it taught people to devalue this life in favor of a next one, and that the habit of doing so outlives the belief. The last man is the alternative, and Nietzsche clearly thinks it is the more likely outcome. The last man is not evil. He is comfortable. He has abolished hardship, risk, great ambition, and anything that might cause suffering. He is tolerant, moderate, well-managed, and mildly amused. He has a little pleasure for the day and a little pleasure for the night. And he regards health. He no longer knows what a star is. And crucially, the last man is happy and considers his happiness the final achievement of humanity. Nietzsche's warning is that the death of God does not automatically produce great free spirits. Left to itself, it produces the last man. Because when meaning collapses, comfort is what fills the space. Part 1 is a sequence of 22 speeches, and it is the most accessible section of the book. Zarathustra is teaching confidently and has not yet run into his own limits. The recurring target is anything that turns a person away from their own life. He attacks the afterworldly, those who invent another world because they cannot bear this one, and says that such worlds were dreamed up by the suffering and the dying. He attacks the despisers of the body and makes the striking claim that the body is a great reason and the mind merely a small instrument of it. He attacks the preachers of death and the professors who teach virtue as an aid to sound sleep. On the state he is savage. The state is called the coldest of all cold monsters, and it lies. It says, I, the state, am the people. He warns against the flies of the marketplace, meaning the noise of public opinion and the people who make a career out of it, and tells his listener to flee into solitude because great things happen away from the market. He redefines several virtues. Love of the neighbor he treats with suspicion, arguing that it is often a flight from oneself, and offers love of the farthest. Love of the not yet existing person you could become in its place. Friendship he rates far above pity, because a friend should be your best enemy, the one who does not soften you. On marriage, he asks the question that undoes most engagements. Do you want a child from this person, and are you the kind of person who should reproduce? He speaks about free death, which is one of the most striking sections. Die at the right time, he says, and treat death as something achieved rather than something suffered. Part 1 ends with the gift-giving virtue and with an instruction that undercuts everything preceding it. Zarathustra tells his disciples to be wary of him and possibly to be ashamed of him because he may have deceived them. Now I bid you lose me and find yourselves, he says, and only when you have all denied me will I return to you. A teacher whose followers merely repeat him has failed, because a repeated value is not a created one. Part 2 is darker. Zarathustra has returned to solitude, then comes back down because his teaching is being distorted and the confidence of part one is gone. The most philosophically important chapter is on self-overcoming, where the will to power is stated directly. This term needs care because it is the second most abused idea in Nietzsche after the Overman. It does not mean the desire to dominate other people, although domination is one of its cruder expressions. Nietzsche is proposing something more fundamental, that every living thing seeks to discharge and extend its strength, that life itself is that striving, and that even the will to truth and the will to obey are forms of it. Wherever I found the living, he says, there I found the will to power. And he adds that life must again and again overcome itself. That last clause is the one to hold. Self-overcoming is not self-improvement in the modern sense. It is the willingness to destroy what you currently are in order to become something else, repeatedly, including your own most cherished convictions. Elsewhere in part two, he takes on pity, which he treats as genuinely dangerous rather than merely soft, because it humiliates the person pitied and corrupts the person pitying. He attacks the tarantulas, his name for the preachers of equality, whose demand for justice he reads as disguised revenge. They want to punish those who are unlike them, and they call it fairness. He is scathing about the famous wise men who serve the people and call it truth-seeking, and about the poets, of whom he says, having been one, that they lie too much. Then comes On Redemption, which sets up the rest of the book. Zarathustra says the will cannot will backwards, it cannot undo what has already happened, and this powerlessness over the past is the source of the spirit of revenge. The resentment against time itself, and its it was. Redemption, he says, would be to recreate every it was into thus I willed it. He does not yet know how that is possible. The answer is waiting in part three. Part two ends with the stillest hour, where a voice without sound tells Zarathustra that he knows his hardest thought and has not yet spoken it, and that he must. He weeps and leaves his friends. Part 3 is where the book reaches its subject, and it is the part Nietzsche himself valued most. In On the Vision and the Riddle, Zarathustra is climbing a mountain path carrying a dwarf on his back. The dwarf is the spirit of gravity, the force that drags everything down into heaviness, seriousness, and resentment, and he taunts Zarathustra. You threw yourself high, but every stone that is thrown must fall. Zarathustra stops and shows him a gateway. On the gateway is written moment. Two paths run from it in opposite directions, backwards into eternity and forwards into eternity, and they contradict one another. He asks the dwarf whether the two paths eternally contradict. The dwarf answers contemptuously that all truth is crooked and time itself is a circle. Zarathustra becomes angry, and the anger is instructive. The dwarf has given the correct answer and understood nothing, because he has made it easy. To say time is a circle, as a piece of cosmic trivia, costs you nothing. To grasp what it means for your own life is a different matter. So Zarathustra spells it out. If everything that can happen has already happened, and this gateway and this conversation and this moonlight have all been here before and must all return, then everything, including you, must run this course again and again eternally. Then the vision changes. He sees a young shepherd writhing on the ground with a heavy black snake hanging out of his mouth, having crawled in while he slept and bitten fast. Zarathustra pulls at the snake and cannot move it. Then he screams at the shepherd, "Bite! Bite its head off!" The shepherd bites, spits out the head, springs up and laughs, and Zarathustra says he has never heard a laugh like it, and that his longing for that laughter now gnaws at him. The snake is the thought itself, the nauseating one. The shepherd is anyone who receives it. You cannot pull it out of someone from outside, and you cannot argue with it. It has to be bitten through, and what is on the other side is not resignation, but laughter. The thought Zarathustra has been avoiding is eternal recurrence, and in the convalescent, he finally calls it up. He summons his abysmal thought, and it makes him physically ill. He collapses and lies as though dead for 7 days. What sickens him is not the cosmology, it is the arithmetic of the consequence. If everything returns eternally, then everything small and mean and contemptible returns too. The last man returns eternally. The rabble returns eternally. The great nausea, he calls it. Not that life is suffering, but that pettiness is immortal. His animals then chatter cheerfully about the great year of becoming, and he calls them buffoons and barrel organs, because they have turned the hardest thought into a jingle. That criticism is aimed at the reader. The test in eternal recurrence is best stated the way Nietzsche put it in The Gay Science. Imagine a demon tells you that you will live this exact life again, innumerable times, with nothing new in it, every pain and every joy in the same sequence. Would you throw yourself down and curse the demon, or would you call it the most divine thing you have ever heard? The question is not whether the universe actually works this way. The question is what kind of life you would have to be living to answer well. And this is where the problem of part two gets solved. The will cannot will backwards, so revenge against the past is inevitable, unless you can will the past. If you can affirm this life so completely that you would demand its exact repetition, then every it was becomes thus I willed it, and the spirit of revenge has nothing left to feed on. Part three closes with the Seven Seals, a chapter of rapturous song in which Zarathustra, having survived his own teaching, sings of his love for eternity. Never yet did I find the woman by whom I wanted children, unless it be this woman whom I love. For I love you, O eternity. Part four is strange, and Nietzsche seems to have known it. He printed it privately in an edition of about 40 copies and did not release it publicly during his active life. It is largely comic, close to farce. Zarathustra, now old, hears a cry of distress and goes looking for the higher man. Over the course of a day, he collects a procession of guests and brings them back to his cave. They are two kings leading a donkey, disgusted by the bad manners of their own age, a scientist who has made himself an expert on the brain of the leech and is bleeding from the arm for his research, a sorcerer who performs great suffering theatrically and admits under pressure that he is a fraud, a retired pope, unemployed since the death of God, the ugliest man who murdered God because he could not bear being seen and pitied by him, a voluntary beggar who left his wealth and now preaches to cows, and Zarathustra's own shadow, a free spirit who has followed him everywhere and lost every conviction and is now homeless. They are all failures, and they are the best humanity currently has. Zarathustra tells them plainly that they are not the overman, that they are bridges at best, and that his hope is not in them. Then, while he is out of the cave, he hears them praying. They have taken the donkey, set it up as a god, and are worshipping it. and the Ars Festival is a genuine piece of religious satire. Give these men freedom from God for one afternoon, and they will manufacture a replacement out of the nearest available animal. The book ends with the drunken song, containing the roundelay that is the most famous lyric Nietzsche wrote. Its argument, compressed: the world is deep, deeper than the day had thought. Woe says pass away, but all joy wants eternity, wants deep, deep eternity. And then the final chapter, The Sign. In the morning, a lion appears at Zarathustra's cave with a flock of doves, and the higher men, hearing it, flee in terror. Zarathustra realizes this was his final temptation and names it pity for the higher men. His last sin was feeling sorry for the best people available and organizing his life around them. He shakes it off. My children are near, he says. My suffering and my pitying, what do they matter? Do I strive for happiness? I strive for my work. And he leaves his cave, glowing and strong, like a morning sun. Pulling the argument out of the poetry, here is what the book actually claims: that the death of God is a real historical event with consequences not yet paid for, and that the greatest of those consequences is nihilism. That the likely response is not liberation, but the last man, comfort, small pleasures, the abolition of risk, and a satisfaction that mistakes itself for an achievement. That the alternative is the overman, understood not as a type of person, but as a direction. The ongoing overcoming of what you currently are. That values are created, not discovered, and that the person who merely inherits values, including good secular ones, has not done the work. That the spirit develops in three stages: camel, lion, and child, and that most people stop at the first, and most rebels stop at the second. That life is will to power, meaning the discharge and extension of strength, and that living things must repeatedly overcome themselves. That the deepest obstacle is the spirit of gravity, the heaviness that turns life into a burden, and that its antidotes are laughter and dance, which Nietzsche means far more seriously than they sound. That resentment against time, against the unchangeable it was, is the hidden root of most moralizing, and that the cure is to will the past rather than to forgive it. That eternal recurrence is the ultimate test of a life. Could you demand this again, exactly, forever? And that pity, including pity for the best people you know, is a trap, because it organizes your life around others' weakness rather than your own work. Some practical advice, because more people abandon this book than finish it. It is not an argument and should not be read as one. There is no thesis defended in sequence. It is closer to a libretto, and the meaning frequently sits in the imagery rather than the statements. It is written against the Bible, in the Bible's own cadence. Recognizing the parody makes long stretches suddenly funny, and Nietzsche is a much more comic writer than his reputation suggests. Zarathustra is not simply Nietzsche's mouthpiece. He is a character who is often wrong, gets frustrated, sulks, is mocked by his own animals, and needs 7 days in bed after confronting his own idea. The book is at least partly about the difficulty of holding the teaching, not just the teaching. Read part one first and slowly. If you want the philosophical core, part three is the destination. Part four can be left until you like the book and read something else alongside it. Beyond Good and Evil and On the Genealogy of Morals, make the same arguments in prose you can actually pin down, and they are the better place to check whether you have understood what Zarathustra is chanting at you. This has to be addressed directly, because it is the first thing many people associate with the book. Nietzsche went insane in 1889 and died in 1900. His sister, Elisabeth Förster Nietzsche, took control of his literary estate and his reputation. She was a German nationalist and an anti-Semite, married to an anti-Semitic agitator with whom she had attempted to found a racially pure German colony in Paraguay. She assembled unpublished notes into a book called The Will to Power, arranged to suit her own views, and later cultivated the Nazi Party. Hitler visited the Nietzsche archive and was photographed contemplating a bust of the philosopher. The important point is that this required extensive misrepresentation, because Nietzsche's own texts say the opposite. He broke with Wagner in part over Wagner's anti-Semitism. He described anti-Semites as people he wanted expelled from the country. He was contemptuous of German nationalism and of the state as such, called it the coldest of all cold monsters, and generally described himself as a good European rather than a German. He praised Jewish contributions to European culture repeatedly. The Overman is not a racial category. Nietzsche's target is the individual who overcomes himself, and a doctrine of inherited superiority is precisely a set of values received rather than created, which is what the book condemns. None of this makes the book innocent. It is genuinely anti-egalitarian, genuinely contemptuous of the herd, and its rhetoric of hardness and rank is available to be abused. The honest position is that the Nazi reading is a distortion, and that Nietzsche wrote in a way that made distortion easy. Beyond the appropriation, here is the reasonable criticism of the book itself. The style is a genuine problem, not just a difficulty. Prophetic writing resists testing. Where a claim is stated as a chant rather than a proposition, you cannot check it, and neither can Nietzsche. A great deal of the book's rhetorical force comes from the fact that it never has to defend anything. Eternal recurrence is unresolved. Nietzsche sometimes appears to advance it as a cosmological fact, and sometimes as an existential test. And scholars still disagree. As physics, it is unsupported. As a test, it is powerful. The book does not distinguish between them clearly. The misogyny is real and should not be tidied away. The chapter on little old and young women ends with an old woman advising Zarathustra not to forget the whip when he goes to women. And there is more of this elsewhere in the book. Attempts to explain it away as irony, or as the character's view, rather than the author's, are not very convincing given how consistently it appears across his work. It is a defect, and reading around it is a choice a reader has to make consciously. The positive program is thin. The book is superb at demolition and vague about construction, which is arguably deliberate, since a specified overman would be another commandment. But the vagueness has a cost. It means almost any project can claim the label, and historically, almost any project has. Part 4 is uneven. The satire is good, the songs are self-indulgent, and Nietzsche's own decision not to publish it is telling. And the self-help reading is the most common misuse today. Zarathustra is regularly quarried for motivational lines about being strong and creating your own values, which turns a book about the terror of a collapsed civilization into a pep talk. That is closer to the last man reading Nietzsche for tips than to anything the book recommends. What survives is considerable. The diagnosis of nihilism was early and has proved durable. The last man is one of the most accurate predictions in modern philosophy. The three metamorphoses is a genuinely useful model of how a person develops. And eternal recurrence, taken as a test rather than a theory, is one of the sharpest questions anyone has ever put to a human life. The value of Thus Spoke Zarathustra is not that it tells you what to do. It refuses to, on principle, and anyone who claims to have extracted a program from it has probably read it as the crowd in the marketplace did. What it does is put a question to you that is very hard to unhear. If the sources of meaning you inherited have quietly stopped working, and the comfortable life on offer is the life of the last man, then what would you have to become for your own existence to be something you could will again, exactly as it is, forever? Nietzsche does not answer that. He suggests it takes a camel, then a lion, then a child, and that the hardest part is the laughter. That was the summary of Thus Spoke Zarathustra by Friedrich Nietzsche. This narration is an original summary and commentary, and no summary substitutes for this book in particular, because the writing is most of the point. If any of it caught you, read the real thing. From the AIIO Book Library, thank you for listening.